I've done some research on you, Berger says almost apologetically. And you're right. I do know who's going to represent Sean Dunn, and it's not good news. In fact, it's pretty damn awful. She puts on her mink coat as we walk out into the hallway. Have you ever met Marino's son? I stop and stare at her, dumbfounded. I don't know anyone who has ever met his son, I reply. Come on, let's get you to your party. I'll explain as we walk out. Berger cradles her books and files, walking slowly over quiet carpet. Rocco Marino, affectionately known as Rocky, is an exceptionally sleazy criminal defense attorney who has an affinity for representing the mob and others who make it worth his while to get them off the hook by any means. He's flashy, loves publicity. She glances over at me. Most of all, he loves to hurt people. That's his power trip. I flip off the hallway lights, throwing us briefly into darkness as we approach the first set of stainless steel doors. Some years ago, in law school, I'm told, she continues, Rocky changed his last name to Caggiano, a final rejection of the father he despises, I suppose. I hesitate, facing her in deep shadows. I don't want her to see the expression on my face, to detect my sense of utter undoing. I have always known that Marino hates his son. I have entertained many theories about why. Maybe Rocky is gay or a drug addict or simply a loser. Certainly it has been clear that Rocky is something of an anathema to his father, and now I know. I am struck by the bitter irony, the shame of it all. My God. Rocky, so-called Caggiano, heard about the case and volunteered? I ask. Could be. Could also be that the Sean Dunn family's organized crime ties have led him to their son. Or hell, maybe Rocky is already connected to them. It may be a combination, personal and Rocky's own connections. But it does smack a little of throwing father and son into the Colosseum. Patricide in front of the world, albeit indirectly. Marino won't necessarily be testifying in Sean Dunn's trial in New York, but it could happen, depending on how this all unfolds. I know how it will unfold. It is all so clear to me. Berger came to Richmond fully intending to insert these cases into the one in New York. I wouldn't be surprised if she doesn't somehow manage to get the Paris cases included as well. But regardless, she says, Sean Dunn will always feel like Marino's case. Cops like him care what happens. And Rocky's representing Sean Dunn puts me in an unfortunate position. If the case were in Richmond, I would go marching up to the judge ex parte and point out the very obvious conflict of interest. Probably get thrown out of his chambers and reprimanded. But at the very least, I might be able to get the his or her honor to request a co-counselor on the defendant's legal team so son doesn't actually cross-examine father. I push a button, and more steel doors open. But I would create a storm of protest, she goes on, and maybe the court would rule in my favor, or if nothing else, I'd use the situation to get sympathy from the jury, show what bad guys Sean Dunn and his counsel are. No matter how your case unfolds in New York, Marino won't be a fact witness. I see where she is going with this. Not in the Susan Pless murder. So you aren't going to have any luck getting rid of Rocky. Exactly right. No conflict. Nothing I can do about it. And Rocky's poison. Our conversation continues into the bay, where we stand in the cold by our cars. The starkness of the bare concrete around us seems a symbol of the realities I now face. Life has turned hard and unforgiving. There is no view, no way out. I can't imagine how Marino will feel when he finds out that the very monster he has helped apprehend will be defended by Marino's estranged son. Clearly Marino doesn't know, I say. Maybe I've been remiss in not telling him yet, she replies, but he's a big enough pain in the ass already. I thought I'd wait and drop this bomb tomorrow or the next day. You know he wasn't happy about my interviewing Sean Dunn. She adds this with a glint of triumph. I could tell. I had a case with Rocky several years ago. Berger unlocks her car door. She leans inside to start it and get the heat going. A wealthy man on business in New York is accosted by a kid with a knife. She straightens up and faces me. The man struggles and manages to wrestle the kid to the ground, bangs the kid's head on the pavement, knocking him out, but not before he stabs the man in the chest. The man dies. The kid is hospitalized for a while, but recovers. Rocky tried to turn the case on self-defense, but fortunately the jury didn't buy it. I'm sure that made Mr. Caggiano a fan of yours for life. What I couldn't prevent was him then representing the kid in a civil suit, asking $10 million for alleged permanent emotional damage, yada yada yada. The murdered man's family finally settled. Why? Because they just couldn't take it anymore. There was a lot of shit happening behind the scenes. Harassment, weird events. They were burglarized. One of their cars was stolen. Their Jack Russell puppy was poisoned. On, and all of it, I'm convinced, was orchestrated by Rocky Marino Caggiano. I just could never prove it. She climbs up into her Mercedes sport utility vehicle. His modus operandi is pretty simple. He gets away with anything he can and puts everybody on trial except the defendant. He is also a very poor loser. I remember Marino telling me years ago he wished Rocky were dead. Might that be part of his motivation, then? I ask. Revenge. Not just getting the father, but getting you, and doing so very publicly. Might be, Berger says to me from the high perch of her SUV. Whatever his motive, I do want you to know I plan to protest anyway. Just can't tell you how much good it will do, since this really doesn't constitute an ethical violation. It's up to the judge. She reaches for her seatbelt and pulls it across her chest. How are you spending Christmas Eve, Kay? So now I am Kay. I have to think for a minute. Christmas Eve is tomorrow. I need to follow up on these cases, the ones with the burns, I reply. She nods. It's important we go back to Shandun's crime scenes while they still exist. Including my house, I think. Might you find some time tomorrow afternoon? She asks. Any time you can give me. I'm working through the holidays. I don't mean to ruin yours. I have to smile at the irony. The holidays. Yes, Merry Christmas. Berger has given me a gift and doesn't even know it. She has helped me make a decision, an important decision, maybe even the most important decision of my life. I'm going to quit my job, and the governor will be the first to know. I'll call you when I'm finished in James City County, I tell Berger. We can try for 2 o'clock. I'll pick you up, she says. Chapter 17. It is almost 10 when I turn off 9th Street into Capitol Square, cruising past the uplit statue of George Washington astride his horse and winding around the south portico of the building Thomas Jefferson designed, where a 30-foot lighted tree decorated with glass balls rises behind thick white columns. I recall that the governor's party was a drop-in and not a dinner, and am relieved at signs that his guests have left. I find not a single car in spaces designated for legislators and visitors. The early 19th-century executive mansion is pale yellow stucco with white trim and columns. According to legend, it was saved by a bucket brigade when Richmonders burned their own city at the end of the Civil War. In the understated tradition of Virginia Christmases, candles glow and fresh wreaths hang in every window, and evergreen swags decorate black iron gates. I roll down my window as a Capitol police officer steps up to my car.
"May I help you?" he asks with an air of suspicion.
"I'm here to see Governor Mitchell. I have been to the mansion a number of times, but not at this hour or in a big Lincoln SUV." I'm Dr. Scarpetta. I'm a little late. If it's too late, I'll understand. Please tell him I'm sorry. The officer brightens.
Didn't recognize you in that car. You get rid of your Mercedes? If you could just wait right here for a minute.
He gets on the phone inside his booth as I look out at Capitol Square and am touched by ambivalence, then sadness. I have lost this city. I can't go back. I can blame it on Shandun, but that isn't all of it, if I'm honest with myself. It is time to do the harder thing. Change. Lucy has inspired courage, or maybe she has made me see myself for what I have become, which is entrenched, static, institutionalized. I have been the chief medical examiner of Virginia for more than a decade. I am edging close to 50. I don't like my only sister. My mother is difficult and her health is bad. Lucy is moving to New York. Benton is dead. I am alone.
Merry Christmas, Dr. Scarpetta.
The Capitol police officer leans close to my window and lowers his voice. The name on his brass tag is Rehnquist.
Just want you to know I hate what happened, but I'm glad you got that SOB. That was real quick thinking on your part.
I appreciate that, Officer Rehnquist.
You won't be seeing me down here any more after the first of the year, he goes on. They've switched me to plainclothes investigations.
I hope that's good.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
We'll miss you.
Maybe I'll see you on a case.
I hope not. If he sees me on a case, that means someone else is dead. He gives me a crisp wave, directing me through the gates.
You can park right in front.
Change. Yes, change. Suddenly I am surrounded by it. In 13 months, Governor Mitchell will be gone too, and that is unsettling. I like him. I especially like his wife, Edith. In Virginia, governors have a one-term limit, and every 4 years the world gets turned on end. Hundreds of employees are moved, fired, and hired. Phone numbers are changed. Computers get formatted. Job descriptions no longer apply, even if the jobs themselves do. Files disappear or are destroyed. Mansion menus are redone or shredded. The only constancy is the mansion staff itself. The same prison inmates do the gardening and small outside tasks, and the same people cook and clean, or at least, if they are rotated, it has nothing to do with politics. Aaron, for example, has been the butler for as long as I have lived in Virginia. He is a tall, handsome African-American, lean and graceful in a long, spotless white coat and snappy black bow tie.
"Aaron, how are you?" I inquire as I step inside an entry hall that is dazzling with crystal lighting that passes its torch, chandelier to chandelier, through sweeping archways all the way to the back of the house. Between the two ballrooms is the Christmas tree decorated in red balls and white lights. Walls and plaster friezes and trim have been recently restored to their original gray and white, and look like Wedgwood. Aaron takes my coat. He indicates he is fine and pleased to see me, using few words because he has mastered the art of being gracious with little noise. Just off the entry hall, on either side, are two rather stiff parlors of Brussels carpet and formidable antiques. Wallpaper in the men's parlor has a Greco-Roman border. A floral border is in the women's. The psychology of these sitting areas is simple. They allow the governor to receive guests without ever really letting them inside the mansion. People are granted an audience at the front door and are not destined to stay long. Aaron guides me past these impersonal historic rooms and up a stairway carpeted in a federal design of black stars against deep red that leads to the first family's personal quarters. I emerge in a sitting area of fir hardwood floors and accessible chairs and couches, where Edith Mitchell waits for me in a flowing red silk pantsuit. She smells faintly exotic as she gives me a hug. "When are we playing tennis again?" she asks dryly, staring at my cast. "It's a very unforgiving sport if you haven't done it in a year, have a fractured arm, and are doing battle with cigarettes again," I say. My reference to the past year is not lost on her. Those who know me are aware that after Benton's murder I vanished into a dark vortex of frantic, perpetual motion. I stopped seeing friends. I didn't go out or have people in. I rarely exercised. All I did was work. I saw nothing that went on around me. I didn't hear what people said to me. I didn't feel. Food had no taste. I scarcely noticed the weather. In Anna's words, I became sensory deprived. Somehow, through it all, I didn't make mistakes in my cases. If anything, I was more obsessive about them. But my absenteeism as a human being was detrimental in the office. I wasn't a good administrator, and it began to show.
Certainly I have been a shitty friend to everyone I know.
How are you? She asks kindly.
About as well as can be expected.
Please sit. Mike's getting off the phone, Edith tells me.
I guess he didn't talk to enough people at the party.
She smiles and rolls her eyes as if she is talking about a naughty boy.
Edith has never really assumed the role of First Lady, not in any tradition the Commonwealth of Virginia has ever seen, and although she may have her detractors, she has also become celebrated as a strong modern woman. She is a historical archaeologist who didn't give up her career when her husband took office and avoids official events she considers frivolous or a poor use of her time. Yet she is her husband's devoted partner and has raised 3 children, now grown or in college. In her late 40s, she has deep brown hair that she wears one length, at her collar and brushed straight back. Her eyes are almost amber, and in them thoughts and questions stir. She has something on her mind.
I was going to take you aside at the party. Kay, I'm glad you called. Thank you for dropping by.
You know it's not like me to pry into your cases, she goes on, but I have to say I'm really unsettled by the one I just read about in the paper. The man found in that awful motel near Jamestown. Mike and I are both very concerned, well, obviously, because of the Jamestown connection.
I'm not aware of a Jamestown connection.
I am puzzled, and my first thought is that information has come in that she knows and I don't.
No connection to the archaeological excavation, not that I'm aware of.
Perceptions, she says simply, if nothing else.
Jamestown is Edith Mitchell's passion. Her own profession drew her to the site years ago, and then she became an advocate for it in her present political position. She has unearthed post-holes and human bones and tirelessly courted the interest of potential financial backers and the media.
I've driven past that motel just about every time I go down there because it's closer to downtown to take Route 5 instead of 64.
A shadow passes over her face.
A real dump. Can't say it would surprise me if something bad happened there. Looks like the sort of place drug dealers and hookers would hang out.
Did you go to the scene?
Not yet.
Can I get you anything to drink, Kay?
I have some very good whiskey I bootlegged back from Ireland last month. I know you like Irish whiskey.
Only if you're having some.
She reaches for the phone and asks Aaron to bring up the bottle of Blackbush and 3 glasses.
What's going on at Jamestown these days?
The air is tainted by a patina of cigar smoke that awakens my frustrating hunger for cigarettes.
I think the last time I was there was 3 or 4 years ago, I tell her.
When we found J.R., she recalls.
Yes.
It's been that long since you were there?
1996, I think.
Well, you must come see what we're doing. It's amazing how the footprint of the fort has changed, and the artifacts, hundreds of thousands of them, as you probably know from the news. We've been doing isotopic studies on some of the bones, which I should think you would find interesting, Kay.
J.R. continues to be our biggest mystery. His isotopic profile wasn't at all consistent with a diet of either corn or wheat, so we didn't know what to make of that, except that maybe he wasn't English. So we sent one of his teeth to a lab in England for DNA.
J.R. stands for Jamestown Rediscovery. It is the prefix given every feature discovered at the excavation site, but in this instance, Edith refers specifically to the 102nd feature unearthed in the 3rd or C layer of soil. JR-102C is a grave. It has become the most celebrated grave of the excavation because the skeleton inside it is thought to be that of a young man who arrived at Jamestown with John Smith in May 1607 and was shot to death that fall. At the first hint of violence inside the coffin-stained clay, Edith and the chief archaeologist called me to the site, where together we brushed back dirt from a 60-caliber musket ball and 21 shot that had fractured the tibia and rotated it 180 degrees so that the foot was pointing backwards. The injury would have torn, if not severed, the popliteal artery behind the knee, and J.R., as he has since become affectionately known, would have bled to death quickly. Of course, there was acute interest in what was immediately dubbed the first murder in America, a rather presumptuous claim, since we can't say for a fact it is a murder or the first one, and the New World was hardly America yet. We did prove from forensic testing that J.R. was shot with a combat load fired from a European weapon called a matchlock musket, and that, based on the spread of the shot, the distance the gun was fired from was approximately 15 feet. He could not possibly have shot himself accidentally. One might deduce that a fellow settler was to blame, leading to the not-so-far-fetched notion that America's karma, sadly, seems to be for us to kill each other. Everything's moved indoors for the winter. Edith slips out of her jacket and drapes it over the back of the sofa. Cataloging artifacts, writing up the findings, all the things we can't get around to while we're working on the site. And, of course, fundraising. That awful part of life that tends to fall in my lap more and more these days, bringing me to my point. I got a rather disturbing phone call from one of our legislators who read about the motel death. He's in an uproar, which is unfortunate, because he's only going to end up doing the very thing he says he doesn't want, which is to draw attention to the case. Uproar over what? I frown. There was very little information in the newspaper. Edith's expression stiffens. Whoever this legislator is, she obviously has no use for him. He's from the Jamestown area, she tells me. He seems to think the case might be a hate crime, that the victim was gay. Footsteps sound softly on the carpeted stairs, and Aaron appears with a tray, a bottle, and 3 tumblers, etched with the seal of the Commonwealth. Needless to say, such a thing could severely compromise what we're doing out there. She chooses her words carefully as Aaron pours Blackbush. A door off the sitting area opens, and the governor emerges from his private office in a draft of cigar smoke, his tuxedo jacket and tie off. "Kay, I'm sorry to keep you waiting," he says to me with a hug. "Brush fires. Maybe Edith has given you the hint." "She was just getting around to it," I reply. Chapter 18 Governor Mitchell is visibly disturbed. His wife gets up to allow us a private conversation, and the two of them have a quick exchange about a call that needs to be made to one of their daughters. Then Edith tells me good night and leaves. The governor lights another cigar. He is a rugged, good-looking man with a former football player's strong body and hair as white as Caribbean sand. "I was going to try to get you tomorrow, but didn't know if you might be off somewhere for the holidays," he begins. "Thanks for coming over." Whiskey heats up my throat with each swallow as we engage in a polite exchange about Christmas plans and how things are going at the Virginia Institute of Forensic Science and Medicine. With every breath I think of Detective Stanfield, the fool. He obviously divulged sensitive case information, and of all people to a goddamn politician, his brother-in-law, Representative Dinwiddie. The governor is an astute man. More importantly, he began his career as a prosecutor. He knows I am furious, and why. "Representative Dinwiddie has a tendency to stir up a hornet's nest," the governor confirms who the troublemaker is. "Dinwiddie is a militant pain in the ass who never lets the world forget his lineage can be traced back, albeit very indirectly, to Chief Powhatan, the father of Pocahontas." "The detective was wrong to have told Dinwiddie anything," I reply, "and Dinwiddie was wrong to have told you or anyone else. This is a criminal case. This is not about the 400th anniversary of Jamestown. It's not about tourism or politics. This is about a man who was most likely tortured and left to burn up in a motel room." "No question about it," Mitchell replies. "But there are certain realities we have to consider. A hate crime that might in any shape or fashion seem connected to Jamestown would be catastrophic." "I'm not aware of any Jamestown connection, beyond the fact that the victim checked into a Jamestown-area motel that offers a business special called the 1607. I'm getting exasperated. "With all the publicity Jamestown has already gotten, that information alone is enough to make the media's antennae go up." He rolls the cigar in his fingertips, and slowly raises it to his lips. It's projected that the 2007 celebration could eventually generate $1 billion in revenue for the Commonwealth. It's our world's fair, Kay. Next year, Jamestown is being commemorated on a coin, a quarter. News crews have been coming to the excavation site in droves. He gets up to stir the fire, and I'm taken back in time to his former rumpled suits and harried demeanor, to his cramped office overwhelmed by files and books in the district court's building. We tried many cases together, some of them the most painful landmarks in my history, those sorts of random, cruel crimes whose victims still haunt my mind. The newspaper carrier abducted from her route and raped and left to slowly die. The old woman shot to death for the hell of it while she was hanging up clothes. The multiple people executed by the Briley brothers. Mitchell and I anguished over so many awful acts of violence, and I missed him when he moved on to a higher calling. Success separates friends. Politics especially is ruinous to relationships, because the very nature of politics is to recreate the person. The Mike Mitchell I knew has been replaced by a statesman who has learned to process his fiery beliefs through safe and meticulously calculated subroutines. He has a plan. He has one for me. "I don't like media feeding frenzies any more than you do," I say to him. He replaces the poker on its brass stand and smokes with his back to the fire, his face flushed from heat. Wood pops and hisses. "What can we do about it, Kay?" "Tell Dinwiddie to keep his mouth shut." "Mr. Headline News?" He smiles wryly. "Who has been very vocal in pointing out that there are those who think Jamestown was the original hate crime against the Native Americans?" "Well, I think it's also rather hateful to kill, scalp, and starve people to death. Seems there's always been plenty of hate to go around since the beginning of time. It won't be me using the term hate crime, Governor. It's not on any form I fill out, not a box to check on a death certificate. As you very well know, such a label is up to the prosecution, the investigators, not the medical examiner."
"What about your opinion?"
I tell him about the second body found in Richmond late this afternoon. I worry the deaths are related.
"Based on?"
His cigar smolders in an ashtray. He rubs his face and massages his temples as if he has a headache. "Bondage," I reply. "Burns."
"Burns? But the first guy was in a fire. Why does the second guy have burns?"
"I suspect torture."
"Gay?"
"No obvious evidence of it in the second victim, but we can't rule it out."
"Do we know who he is or if he's local?"
"So far, no. Neither victim has personal effects."
"Suggesting someone involved doesn't want them identified. Or robbery. Or both."
"Possibly."
"Tell me more about the burns," the governor says.
I describe them. I mention the case Berger had in New York, and the governor's anxieties become more palpable. Anger flashes across his face.
"This sort of speculation needs to stay in this room," he says. "Last thing we need is another New York connection. Jesus God."
"There's no evidence of a connection, unless someone simply got the idea from the news," I reply. "I can't say for a fact a heat gun was used in the cases here, for that matter."
"Do you find it a little strange that Chandon's murders have a New York connection? So the trial moves up there. Now we suddenly have two murders here that are similar to yet another New York murder?"
"Strange, yes. Very strange. Governor, all I can tell you with certainty is I've no intention of making the autopsy reports a major element in fueling other people's political agendas. I will, as always, stick to the facts and avoid speculating. I suggest we think in terms of managing rather than suppressing."
"God damn. All hell's going to break loose," he mutters in a cloud of smoke.
"I hope not," I tell him.
"And your case? The French werewolf, as some people are calling him?"
Mitchell finally gets around to that.
"What's all that going to do to you, hmm?"
He sits down again and gives me one of his earnest looks. I sip my whiskey, wondering how to tell him. There really is no graceful way to launch it. What's that going to do to me? I smile ruefully.
Has to be awful. I'm just glad you nailed the son of a bitch.
Tears brighten his eyes, and he quickly looks away. Mitchell is the prosecutor again. We are comfortable. We are old colleagues, old friends. I am touched, very touched, and at the same time depressed. The past is past. Mitchell is the governor. He will probably land in Washington next. I am the chief medical examiner of Virginia, and he is my boss. I am about to tell him I have to give up my position as chief. I don't think it's in my best interest, or the best interest of the Commonwealth, for me to continue to serve in my position. I'm out with it. He just stares at me. I'll submit this more formally, of course, in writing, but I've made my decision. I am resigning as of January 1st. Of course, I'll stay on as long as you need me while you search for my replacement. I wonder if he was expecting this. Maybe he is relieved. Maybe he is angry. You're not a quitter, Kay, he says. That's one thing you've never been. Don't let assholes run you off, goddammit. I'm not quitting my profession, just changing the boundaries. No one's running me off. Oh, yes, boundaries, the governor observes, leaning back against the cushions and studying me. Sounds like you're becoming a hired gun. Please. We both share the same contempt for experts whose choice of which side to represent is based on money, not justice. You know what I mean. He relights his cigar and stares off, already forming a new plan. I can see his mind working. I'll go to work as a private contractor, I say, but I will never be a hired gun. Actually, what I've got to do first won't earn me a dime, Mike. The case, New York. I've got to help, and it's going to take a lot of my time. All right. Then it's simple. You go to work as a private contractor, Kay, and the Commonwealth will be your first client. We'll hire you as acting chief until there's a better solution for Virginia. I hope your rates are reasonable, he drolly adds. This isn't at all what I expected to hear. You look surprised, he observes.
I am.
Why? Maybe Buford Ryder could explain, I start to say, and indignation rises again. We have two women horrendously murdered in this city, and no matter what, I don't feel it's right that their killer is now in New York. I can't help it, Mike. I feel it's my fault. I feel I've compromised the cases here because Shun Dunn came after me. I feel as if I've turned into a liability.
Ah, Buford, Mitchell blandly comments.
Well, he's a good enough guy, but a lousy Commonwealth's attorney, Kay. And I don't think letting New York have the first crack at Shun Dunn is all that bad an idea, in light of the circumstances. His words have the weight of many considerations, not the least of which, I suspect, is the way Europeans would react if Virginia executed a French native, and Virginia is known for the number of people it puts to death every year. I autopsy every one of them. I know the statistics all too well.
Even I would be a little at odds as to how to handle this case, Mitchell adds with a drawn-out pause.
I have the sensation that the sky is about to fall. Secrets crackle like static electricity, but there is no point in my prying. Governor Mitchell will not be coaxed into relaying any information he isn't ready to give.
Try not to take all this too personally, Kay, he gives me advice. I support you. I'll continue to do so. I've worked with you a long time and know you.
Everybody tells me not to take any of this personally.
I smile a little.
The ominous feeling strengthens. He will continue to support me, as if to imply there are reasons he shouldn't.
Edith, my kids, staff all tell me the same thing, he is saying. And I still take things personally. I just don't let on that I do.
Then you had nothing to do with Berger? With this rather remarkable change of venue, so to speak?
I have to ask.
He sharpens his ash to a point, slowly rolling the cigar, puffing, buying time. He did have something to do with it. He had everything to do with it, I am convinced.
She's really good, Kay.
His non-answer is an answer. I accept this. I resist prying. I simply ask him exactly how he is acquainted with her.
Well, you know, we both went to UVA law school, he says. Then when I was AG, I had a case. You should remember, since it had to do with your office. The socialite from New York who took out a huge life insurance policy on her husband 1 month before she murdered him in a Fairfax hotel. She tried to pass it off as a suicidal shooting.
I remember all too well. She later named my office and me in a lawsuit, accusing us of racketeering, among other things, for allegedly colluding with the insurance company to falsify records so no claim was paid to her. Berger got involved because it turns out the woman's first husband had died under suspicious circumstances in New York some years earlier, Mitchell says. Seems he was an older man, frail, and drowned in the bathtub just 1 month after the wife had taken out a huge life insurance policy. The medical examiner found bruises that might have indicated a struggle and pended the case for a very long time, hoping the investigation would turn up something conclusive. It didn't. The DA's office just couldn't make the case. Then the woman sues the medical examiner there, too, for slander, emotional duress, baloney like that. I had numerous conversations with the people up there, mostly Bob Morgenthau, the DA, but also with Jamie, comparing notes. Guess I'm wondering if the feds might try to make Shandun flip and snitch on his cartel family. Let's make a deal, I say. And then what?
I think you can bank on that, Mitchell replies solemnly.
So that's it. Now I know. He is guaranteed not to get the death penalty? That's the deal.
Morgenthau is not known for putting people to death, he says. But I am. I'm a tough old bird.
The governor has just clued me in on the negotiations that have gone on. The feds get to work on Shandun. In exchange, Shandun is tried in New York, where he is assured he will not get the death penalty. No matter what happens, Governor Mitchell doesn't look bad. It is no longer his problem. It is no longer Virginia's problem. We won't incite an international incident by sticking a needle in Shandun's arm. That's a shame, I sum it up. Not that I believe in capital punishment, Mike, but it's a shame that politics have gotten into the mix. I just listened to several hours of Shandun's lies. He's not going to help anyone take down his family. Never. And I'll tell you something else. If he ends up in Kirby or Bellevue, he'll somehow get out. He'll kill again. So on the one hand, I'm glad there's an excellent prosecutor on the case and not Ryder. Ryder's a coward. But on the other hand, I'm sorry we've lost control of Shandun. Mitchell leans forward and places his hands on his knees, a ready position signaling our conversation has ended. He isn't going to discuss the matter further with me, and that also speaks volumes.
Good of you to come, Kay, he says.
He holds my stare. This is his way of saying, don't ask. Chapter 19. Aaron leads me back down the stairs and gives me a slight smile as he opens the front door. The trooper waves at me as I drive through the gates. There is a sense of closure, of finality as I wind through Capitol Square, the mansion disappearing in my rear-view mirror. I have left something. I have just walked away from my life as I have known it, and I have discovered a wrinkle of distrust for a man I have always admired so much. No, I don't think Mitchell has done anything wrong, but I know he hasn't been forthright with me. Not totally. He is directly responsible for Shandun's leaving our jurisdiction, and the reason is politics, not justice. I sense it. I am sure of it. Mike Mitchell is not the prosecutor anymore. He is the governor. Why should I be surprised? What the hell did I expect? Downtown seems unfriendly and foreign as I follow 8th Street to get on the expressway. I watch the faces of people driving past and marvel that virtually none of them is present in the moment they occupy. They drive and look in the mirror and reach for something on the seat or fool with the radio or talk on the phone or to their passengers. They don't notice the stranger watching them. I see faces so clearly that I can determine if they are handsome or pretty or have scars from acne or good teeth. I realize that at least one big difference between killers and their victims is killers are present. They live entirely in the moment, taking in their surroundings, intensely aware of every detail and how it might benefit or compromise them. They watch strangers. They fix on a face and decide to follow the person home. I wonder if this is how the two young men, my latest patients, were selected. I wonder what sort of predator I'm dealing with here. I wonder what the governor's real agenda is for wanting to see me tonight, and why he and the First Lady questioned me about the James City County case. Something is going on. Something bad. I call my home phone and have 7 messages. 3 of them are from Lucy. She doesn't tell me what she wants, only that she is trying to reach me. I try her on her mobile phone, and when she answers, I feel tension. I sense she is not alone. "Is everything all right?" I ask her. She hesitates. "Aunt Kay, I'd like to bring Tian by." "McGovern's in Richmond?" I say in surprise. "We can be at Anna's house in about 15 minutes," Lucy tells me. Signals are coming fast and strong. I can't identify what it is that taps my subconscious, trying to make me recognize a very important truth. What is it, damn it? I am so unsettled I am jumpy and confused. A motorist behind me blares his horn and my heart jerks. I gasp. I realize the light has turned green. The moon is incomplete and shrouded by clouds, the James River a plain of darkness below the Huguenot Bridge, as I pass into the south side of the city. I park in front of Anna's house behind Lucy's Suburban, and instantly Anna's front door opens. It appears that Lucy and McGovern have arrived only a moment before me. Both of them and Anna are in the foyer beneath the sparkling crystal chandelier. McGovern's eyes meet mine, and she smiles reassuringly, as if to let me know I will be all right. She has cut her hair short and is still a very attractive woman, slender and boyish in black leggings and a long leather jacket. We hug, and I am reminded she is firm and in charge, but gentle. I am glad to see her, immensely glad. "Come in, come in," Anna says. "Merry Christmas Eve, almost. Isn't this fun?" But her expression is anything but fun. Her face is drawn, her eyes bruised by worry and fatigue. She catches me staring and tries to smile. All of us head toward the kitchen at the same time. Anna is asking about drinks and snacks. Has everyone eaten? Do Lucy and McGovern want to stay here for the night? No one should be in a hotel on Christmas Eve. That is criminal. On and on she talks, and her hands are unsteady as she pulls out bottles from a cabinet, lining up whiskies and liquors. The signals are firing so rapidly now I barely hear what anyone is saying. Then the moment of recognition thunders in my psyche. I get it. The truth runs through me in a jolting current as Anna pours me a scotch. I told Berger I have no deep, dark secrets. What I meant was I have always been private. I don't tell people anything that could be used against me. I am by nature cautious. But lately I have talked to Anna. We have spent hours exploring the deepest crevices of my life. I have told her things I am not sure I even knew, and I have never paid her for these sessions. They are not protected by doctor-patient confidentiality. Rocky Caggiano could subpoena Anna, and as I look at her now, I assume this is what has occurred. I take the tumbler of scotch from her, our eyes locked. "Something's happened," I say. She glances away. I play out the scenario. Berger will get the subpoena quashed. It is ridiculous. Caggiano is harassing me, trying to intimidate me, plain and simple, and it won't work. Fuck him. I have everything figured out and resolved just that fast, because I am a pro at ducking any truth that directly impacts my inner self, my well-being, my feelings. "Tell me, Anna," I say. Silence fills the kitchen. Lucy and McGovern have stopped talking. Lucy comes over and hugs me. "We're here for you," she says. "You bet." McGovern gives me a thumbs up. Their efforts to reassure me leave a wake of foreboding as they disappear into the living room. Anna looks at me, and it is the first time I have ever seen even a hint of tears in my stoical Austrian friend. "I have done a terrible thing, Kay." She clears her throat and woodenly fills another tumbler with ice from the refrigerator ice maker. She drops an ice cube on the floor, and it slides out of reach behind the trash can. "This sheriff's deputy. I could not believe it when the buzzer sounded at my gate this morning. And here is a deputy with a subpoena. To do this to me at home is bad enough. Always I get subpoenas at my office. That is not so unusual. I do get called in as an expert witness from time to time, as you know. I cannot believe he did this to me. I trusted him." Doubt. Denial quakes. The first breath of fear touches my central nervous system. "Who did this to you?" I say. "Rocky?" "Who?" She looks bewildered. "Oh, God," I mutter. "Oh, God." I lean against the countertop. "This isn't about Shandun. It can't be. If Caggiano didn't subpoena Anna, then that leaves only one other possibility, and it isn't Berger. Of course the prosecution would have no reason to talk to Anna." I think of the odd phone call from my bank, the message from AT&T, and of Ryder's behavior and the look on his face when he saw me in Marino's truck last Saturday night. I play through the governor's sudden need to see me, his evasiveness, even Marino's sour moods and the way he has been avoiding me, and I take another look at Jack's sudden loss of hair and fears about being the chief. Everything slips into place and forms an unbelievable composite. I am in trouble. Dear God, I am in serious trouble. My hands begin to shake. Anna is rambling, stuttering, tripping over her words as if she has involuntarily resorted to what she learned first in life, which is not English. She struggles. She confirms what I now am forced to suspect. Anna has been subpoenaed by a special grand jury. A Richmond special grand jury is investigating me to see if there is sufficient evidence to indict me in the murder of Diane Bray. Anna has been used, she says. She has been set up. Who set you up? Ryder? Buford's behind this? I ask. Anna nods affirmatively. I never will forgive him. I told him, she swears. We go into the living room where I reach for a cordless phone on an elegant yew wood stand. You realize you don't have to be telling me all this, Anna. I try Marino's home number. I will myself to be remarkably calm. I'm sure Buford wouldn't appreciate it, so maybe you shouldn't talk to me. I do not care what I should or should not do. The moment I got the subpoena, Buford called and explained what he needed from me. I called Lucy right away. Anna continues speaking in fractured English as she stares blankly at McGovern. It seems to occur to Anna that she has no idea who McGovern is or why she is in her house. What time did the deputy show up at your house with the subpoena? I ask Anna. Marino's phone cuts straight into his voicemail. Damn it, I mutter. He is on the line. I leave him the message to call me. It is urgent. About 10 o'clock this morning, Anna answers my question. Interesting, I reply. About the same time Shandun was transported out of here to New York, and then Bray's memorial service and when I first met Berger. In your mind, how does all of this connect? McGovern is listening carefully with her astute, experienced eyes fastened on me. She was one of ATF's most gifted certified fire investigators before she got promoted to supervision by the very people who would eventually cause her to quit. I'm not sure, I reply, except Berger was interested in seeing who showed up at Bray's service. I'm now wondering if she wanted to see if I would, and if that might indicate she knows I'm being investigated and is checking me out on her own. Anna's phone rings. Zenner residence, I answer.
What's going on? Marino says loudly over his television.
I'm just beginning to figure that out, I reply. He knows instantly by my tone not to ask questions, but to get in his truck and drive over here right now. It is time for truth. No games and no secrets, I tell him. We wait for him in front of the fire in Anna's living room, where a tree is wrapped in white lights and garlands and decorated with glass animals and wooden fruit, with presents underneath. I'm silently going through every word I have said to Anna, trying to remember what she surely will when Ryder asks her under oath about me in front of jurors who have been seated and sworn to decide if I should go on trial for murder. My heart is seized by frigid fingers of raw fear, yet I sound reasonable when I speak. I am outwardly steady as Anna goes into detail about how she has been set up. It began when Ryder contacted her on Tuesday, December 14. She spends a good 15 minutes explaining that Ryder called as a friend, a concerned friend. People were talking about me. He was hearing things that he felt he must check out, and he knew Anna and I are close. "This isn't making any sense," Lucy says. "Diane Bray hadn't even been murdered yet. Why was Ryder talking to Anna that early on?" "I don't get it," McGovern agrees. "Something really stinks about this." She and Lucy sit on the floor in front of the fire. I am in my usual rocking chair, and Anna is on the ottoman, sitting rigidly. "When Ryder called on the 14th, what exactly did he say to you?" I ask Anna. "How did he introduce the conversation?" She meets my eyes.
"There was concern about your mental health. That is what he said right off."
I simply nod. I am not offended. Although it is true I wobbled badly after Benton was murdered, I have never been mentally ill. I am secure in my sanity and my ability to reason and think. I have been guilty only of running from pain. I know I didn't handle Benton's death well, I admit.
"How do you handle something like that well?" Lucy replies.
"No, no, that is not what Buford meant," Anna says. "He wasn't calling about how you've managed grief, Kay. He was calling about Diane Bray, about your relationship with her."
"What relationship?"
I instantly wonder if Bray called Ryder. Yet one more trap she set for me. I hardly knew her. Anna's eyes are steady on mine, the shadow from the fire wavering on her face. I am startled again by how old she looks, as if she has aged 10 years in a day.
"You'd had a series of confrontations with her." "You told me so," she replies.
"Instigated by her," I am quick to say. "We didn't have a personal relationship, not even a social one."
"I think when you go to war against someone, that is personal. Even people who hate each other have a personal relationship, if you see what I am saying. Certainly she had gotten very personal with you, Kay. Starting rumors, lying about you, creating a bogus medical column on the internet that made it appear you were the one writing it, making a fool out of you and getting you into trouble with the Secretary of Public Safety, even with the governor."
"I was just with the governor. I don't feel I'm in trouble with him at all."
I say this and at the same time find it curious. If Mitchell knows I am being investigated by a special grand jury, and I know he must, then why didn't he accept my resignation and thank God to be rid of me and my messy life?
"She also put Marino's career in jeopardy because he is your sidekick," Anna goes on. The only thought that flashes is Marino would not appreciate being called my sidekick. As if on cue, the intercom blares, announcing that he is at the front gates.
"Sabotaging your career, in other words." Anna gets up. "Correct? Isn't that what you have told me?"
She pushes a button on a console on the wall, suddenly energized. Anger burns off her depression.
"Yes? Who is it?" she snaps into the speaker.
"Me, baby."
The rude sounds of Marino and his truck fill the living room.
"Oh, he calls me baby again. I will kill him."
Anna throws her hands up in the air. She goes to the door, and then Marino is walking into the living room. He left his house in such a hurry he didn't bother with a coat, only a gray sweatsuit and tennis shoes. He is dumbstruck when he sees McGovern sitting by the fire, looking up at him from her Indian-style position on the floor.
"Well, I'll be damned,"
Marino says. Look what the cat drug in.
Great to see you, too, Marino, McGovern replies.
Someone want to tell me what the hell's going on?
He moves a wing chair closer to the fire and sits, going from one face to the other, trying to read the situation, acting obtuse, as if he doesn't already know. I believe he knows. Oh, yes, now it is clear why he has been acting so strange. We get into it. Anna continues to unravel what happened in the days preceding Jamie Berger's coming to Richmond. Berger continues to dominate, as if she is sitting in our midst. I don't trust her. And at the same time, I feel my life may very well be in her hands. I try to remember where I was on December 14th, moving backwards from today, December 23rd, until I land on that Tuesday. I was in Lyon, France, at Interpol's headquarters, where I met Jay Talley for the first time. I run through that encounter, reconstructing the two of us alone at a table in Interpol's cafeteria. Marino took an instant dislike to Jay and stalked off. During lunch, I told Jay about Diane Bray, about my problems with her, and that she was doing all she could to persecute Marino, including throwing him back into uniform and on midnight shift. What was it Jay called her? Toxic waste in tight clothes. Apparently the two of them had run-ins when she was with the D.C. police and he was briefly assigned to ATF headquarters. He seemed to know all about her. Can it be coincidence that the very day I discussed her with him, Ryder called Anna and questioned her about my relationship with Bray and made implications about my mental health? I wasn't going to tell you this, Anna continues in a hard voice. I shouldn't tell you this. But now that I am clearly going to be used against you...
What do you mean, used against her? Marino butts in.
Originally I was hoping to guide you, to help allay these allegations about your mental health, Anna says to me. I did not believe it. And if I had any doubt, and maybe there was just a slight doubt because I had not seen you in so long, then I wanted to talk to you anyway, out of concern. You are my friend. Buford assured me that anything I could find out was not something he planned to do anything with. Our conversations were supposed to be private, his and mine. He said nothing, absolutely nothing, about accusing you.
Ryder? Marino scowls. He asked you to be some kind of fucking snitch?
Anna shakes her head.
A guide, she uses that word again.
That fucking figures. The loser.
Marino's anger springs forth.
He had to know if Kay was mentally stable. Certainly you can see why he needs to know that, if she was going to be his star witness. I always thought this was about your being a star witness, not a suspect.
Suspect my ass,
Marino scowls. He makes no pretenses now. He knows exactly what is going on. Marino, I know you're not supposed to tell me I'm being investigated by a special grand jury for the murder of Diane Bray, I say to him evenly. But out of curiosity, I'm wondering how long have you known? For example, when you ushered me out of my house on Saturday night, you knew then, didn't you? That's why you watched me like a hawk inside my own house, so I didn't do something sneaky like dispose of evidence or God knows what. That's why you wouldn't let me drive my car, right? Because you guys needed to see if there might be evidence in it. Maybe Diane Bray's blood? Fibers? Hair? Something that would put me at her house the night she was killed?
My tone is cool but searing.
Jesus fucking Christ! Marino erupts. I know you didn't do nothing. Ryder's the biggest fuckhead, and I told him that. I've been telling him that every day. What did you ever do to him, huh? You want to tell me why the hell he's doing this to you?
You know what? I stare hard at him. I'm not going to hear one more time that everything is my fault. I didn't do a damn thing to Ryder. I don't know what's gotten him on this ridiculous kick unless it's Jay planting stuff.
And I guess that ain't your fault either, sleeping with him.
He's not doing this because I slept with him, I fire back. If he's doing anything, it's because I only slept with him once.
McGovern is frowning, leaning against the hearth. She says, Dear old Jay, Mr. Squeaky Clean, pretty boy, Funny, I've never had a good feeling about him.
I told Buford that you are definitely not mentally ill.
Anna sets her jaw squarely and looks at me fiercely. He wanted to know if I thought you were competent to assist him, if I think you are stable. See, he lied. This was supposed to be about our assisting him in the trial of Shandun. I never imagined. I cannot believe Buford would slither out from under a rock and subpoena me like this.
She places a hand on her breast as if her heart is bothering her, and briefly shuts her eyes.
Are you all right, Anna? I start to get up.
She shakes her head from side to side.
I will never be all right again. I would never have talked to you, Kay, if I thought such a thing would happen.
Did you tape her? Take notes? McGovern asks.
Of course not.
Good.
But if I am asked, she starts to say.
I understand, I reply.
Anna, I understand. What's done is done.
It is now that I must tell Marino the other news. While we are on such dreadful subjects, he may as well hear it all.
Your son, Rocky, I say his name and nothing more. Maybe I am trying to see if Marino already knows this, too.
He turns to Stone.
What about him?
It appears he is representing Shandun, I reply.
Marino's face darkens to a deep, scary red. For a moment, no one speaks. He doesn't know. Then Marino says in a flat, hard tone,
He would do something like that. Probably has something to do with what's happening to you, too, if that's possible.
Funny thing about it, I halfway wondered if he had something to do with Shandun's ending up here.
Why would you wonder that? McGovern asks in amazement.
He's a mob boy, that's why. Probably knows Big Papa Shandun over there in Paris and would like nothing better than causing me trouble here.
I think it's time you talk about Rocky, I tell him.
You got any bourbon in this house? Marino asks Anna.
She gets up and leaves the room.
Aunt Kay, you can't stay here anymore. Lucy says to me in a quiet, urgent voice.
You can't talk to her anymore, Kay, McGovern adds.
I don't answer.
Of course they are right. Now, on top of it all, I have lost my friend.
So, did you tell her anything?
Marino says to me in an accusing tone that has become all too familiar.
I told her the world was better off without Diane Bray, I reply. In other words, I basically said I'm glad she's dead.
So's everybody who knew her, Marino retorts. And I'll be glad to tell the fucking special grand jury that.
Not a helpful statement, but doesn't mean you murdered anybody, McGovern says to me.
Not helpful is right, Marino mutters. Damn, I hope Anna don't tell Ryder you're glad Bray was whacked, he says to me.
This is so absurd, is my response.
Well, Marino replies, yes and no, Doc.
You don't have to talk to me about this, I tell him. Don't put yourself in a bad spot, Marino.
Oh, fuck it, he waves me off. I know you didn't kill that damn bitch, but you gotta look at it from the other side. You had problems with her. She was trying to get you fired. You've been acting a little hinky ever since Benton died, or at least that's what people have been saying, right? You have a confrontation with Bray in a parking lot. The theory is, you was jealous of this new big-shot police lady. She was making you look bad and complaining about you. So you killed her and disguised it to look like it was the same guy who whacked Kim Luong, and who better to do that than you, right? Who more capable of the perfect murder than you, right? And you had access, first dibs on all the evidence. You could have beaten her to death and planted Wolfman's hairs on her body, even switched swabs so they come up with his DNA. And it don't look good that you took that evidence from the Paris morgue and brought it over here either. Or took that water sample. Ryder thinks you're a nutcase, I hate to tell you. And I gotta add that he don't like you personally and never has because he's got the balls of a soprano and don't like powerful women. He don't even like Anna, if the truth be known. The burger thing's kind of the best revenge. He really hates her.
Silence.
I wonder if they're going to subpoena me, Lucy says. Chapter 20.
Ryder thinks you're a nutcase, too, Marino tells my niece. The only point we're in agreement on.
Any chance Rocky's been involved with the Shandun family?
McGovern looks at Marino.
In the past? You're serious when you say you wondered it?
Huh. Marino snorts. Rocky's been involved with criminals most of his goddamn life. But do I know details about what he does with his fucking time, day to day, month to month? No, I can't honestly swear to that. I just know what he is. Scum. He was born bad. Bad seed. As far as I'm concerned, he ain't my son.
Well, he is your son, I tell him.
Not in my book. He took after the wrong side of my family, Marino insists. In New Jersey, we had good Marinos and bad Marinos. I had an uncle who was with the mob, another uncle who was a cop. Two brothers, different as night and day. And then when I turned 14, Uncle Asshole Louie had my other uncle whacked, my other uncle being the cop, also named Pete. I was named after Uncle Pete. Shot down when he was in his own front yard picking up his fucking newspaper. We never could prove Uncle Louie had it done, but everyone in the family believed it. I still believe it.
Where's your Uncle Louie now? Lucy asks as Anna returns with Marino's drink.
I heard he died a couple years back. I didn't keep up with him. Never had nothing to do with him.
He takes the glass from Anna.
But Rocky's his spittin' image. Even looked like him when he was growing up, and from day one was bent, warped, just a piece of living shit. Why do you think he took the name Caggiano? Because that's my mother's maiden name, and Rocky knew it would really piss me off if he crapped on my mother's name. There's some people who can't be fixed. There's some just born bad. Don't ask me to explain it, because Doris and I did everything we could for that boy. Even tried sending him off to military school, which was a mistake. He ended up liking it. Liked the hazing part, doing really crappy things to the other boys. Nobody picked on him. Not even on the first damn day. He was big like me and just so goddamn mean the other kids didn't dare touch a hair on his head.
This is not right, Anna mutters as she sits back down on the ottoman. What's Rocky's motive for taking this case?
I know what Berger said, but I want to hear Marino's slant.
To spite you?
He'll get off on the attention. A case like this will create a circus.
Marino doesn't want to say the obvious, that just maybe Rocky wants to humiliate, to best his father.
Does he hate you? McGovern asks him.
Marino snorts again and his pager vibrates.
What eventually happened to him? I ask. You sent him off to military